From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The drug war, federal prisons, and bipartisanship. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Too many Americans are going to prison for far too long with no benefit to public safety. That today from Democratic Attorney General Eric Holder. Many Republicans, even Rand Paul and Rick Perry of Texas, agree the war on drugs has gone too far with long mandatory sentences for minor crimes. Prison costs are rising with little to show for the money. And Holder's reform proposals just might be accepted on Capitol Hill. Those concerned about racial disparities among inmates are saying, it's about time. Today's talking point, are the CIA and the U.S. Senate spying on each other? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Democrats and Republicans now agree federal prisons are overcrowded, vastly expensive, and ineffective. 50% of inmates are serving mandatory sentences for drug crimes. Today, Attorney General Eric Holder laid out a set of reforms that might well be adopted. Today's talking point, the dispute between the CIA and U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein about the constitutional separation of powers and the CIA's alleged abuse of prisoners during the so-called War on Terror. First, this news update. Despite continued warnings from President Obama, German Chancellor Merkel, and other Western leaders, Russia has announced extensive military activities on the border with eastern Ukraine. Michael Weiss is editor-in-chief of The Interpreter. That's a daily online journal that translates media from the Russian press into English. Michael Weiss, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what they've announced and what they're actually doing.
Well, actually, first they denied they were doing anything, and then they said, oh, actually, yeah, we are holding a military exercise. It's more than 80,000 soldiers, according to the Ukrainians, which are monitoring the situation very closely, 270 tanks, 370 artillery systems, and quite a number of combat aircraft. It's important to note that the parachute drops that have been part of these exercises haven't been waged on such a scale by Russia since the end of the collapse of the Soviet Union. So this is very clearly a prelude and a threat of a full-scale Russian military invasion of Ukraine. There's no other way to read this. And the important thing to remember is the last time the Russians announced a snap drill 2 weeks ago, they ended with the invasion of Crimea. So the Ukrainians are extremely nervous. Today, in fact, for the second time this week, Russian military fired upon a Ukrainian patrol plane near the border. I think what's happening here is as follows, and this is what we've seen now in the course of a week in Crimea. The Russians took over and essentially have waged a de facto annexation of the Crimean Peninsula, hoping that this would prompt some sort of retaliatory measures by Ukrainian military personnel or by the Ukrainian government. So far, and remarkably, the Ukrainians have been resistant of taking any of this bait. They haven't provoked the Russians, even though they have been provoked by them. They've been spat at. They've been cursed. Obviously, there's all this sort of propaganda about neo-Nazis and fascists running Kiev now and all that sort of thing. But I think what Putin is calculating on is he wants this sort of Georgia scenario to play out, you know, prompt the other country to fire and then use that as a pretext to just kind of wage full-scale war. So it's an extraordinarily tense moment right now. I mean, I think we're on the knife edge here.
Now, you, Michael Weiss, are here in the United States. You're reading this stuff online for the Interpreter, both Russian and Ukrainian reports?
Both the Russian and Ukrainian reports, yeah. There's quite a lot of good information coming out of the Russian press, although all of this has to be said, that at the moment, actually, there's been a clampdown on free and independent Russian media. The newspaper Lenta was essentially, they had their editor sacked for running an interview with the leader of Right Sector, which is a far-right Ukrainian nationalist group. The Russians have accused Lenta newspaper, but just by conducting the interview, of promoting terrorism. So the editor was sacked and replaced by some pro-Kremlin stooge, essentially. And now it seems like the entire newspaper, all the staff, have resigned today. So what is happening now? And it's important to remember, Russian foreign policy is inextricable from its domestic policy. You're seeing, sort of chest-pounding military occupation in southern Ukraine, combined with now a very credible threat that eastern Ukraine could be next, and its borders could be transgressed by Russian tanks and God knows what else, combined with this this assault or this clampdown on Russian civil society and dissidents and just a kind of an independent news completely. So I think, look, what Putin's reaction to everything. I mean, today the talk is, can Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, sort of put pressure on him to essentially pull back from the brink? The threat of sanctions that are coordinated now by the U.S. and the EU, all of this stuff. So far, his reaction has been one of complete and utter indifference.
Is there anything in the Russian press about what the Western powers are saying, or is there a blackout on that kind of news?
No. I mean, it depends what you mean by the Russian press. The pro-Kremlin press, of course, thinks that, the United States is being completely hypocritical, has no business.
But are they quoting Angela Merkel and other Western leaders?
Sure. Yeah, they're quoting them. But, I mean, the spin on it is as I say, that these people have no business interfering in Russia's right to reclaim territory that was only ever ceded to Ukraine in 1954. What the Russians call, or what observers of Russia, I should say, call the whataboutism. Any talk of a violation of Ukrainian sovereignty or territorial integrity, which has been, a major theme of President Obama's criticism of the occupation of Crimea, is met with, well, Iraq or Libya or Yemen or Somalia.
Okay.
So it's just counter accusations of that sort. But look, there are still journalists in Russia who are telling the truth and are trying to report the situation credibly and accurately. The problem
okay. Well, Michael Weiss, I'm sorry to say we are short of time. Editor-in-Chief of The Interpreter, once again, daily online journal that translates media from the Russian press into English. Remind our listeners, John Kerry is planning to meet with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, tomorrow to see what can be done. The referendum in Crimea, of course, is on Sunday. In a moment, the drug war, federal prisons, and bipartisanship on To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. The U.S. population has risen by one-third since 1980. At the same time, the federal prison population has risen 800%. And there's little to show for a lot of taxpayer money. That's what Attorney General Eric Holder told the independent U.S. Sentencing Commission today, proposing that mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes be scaled back.
As it stands, and as this commission has recognized, certain types of cases result in too many Americans going to prison for too long, and at times for no truly good law enforcement reason. Although the United States comprises just 5% of the world's population, we incarcerate almost a quarter of the world's prisoners.
Eric Holder talking today once again before the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Daniel Wilhelm is Vice President and Chief Program Officer of the Vera Institute of Justice. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
How'd we get this way?
Well, to understand where we find ourselves now, you have to look back in some recent history and understand that the mandatory sentencing schemes that exist at the federal level and have existed for years in most of the states are really a reflection of a lot of the fears that existed in over the last 25 years when crime rates were much higher than we find them to be right now, when there was great trepidation about the rise in crack cocaine, and when you had random acts of violence, such as the infamous case of the rape of the female jogger in Central Park, that were really galvanizing and driving public opinion around being fearful of crime. And as is their wont, legislators and politicians of all stripes, both at the federal and the state levels, responded to this. And one of the main ways in which they responded was by presuming that the proper reaction to this fear and the right way to control the crime problem was to enact a difficult to penetrate skein of mandatory minimum sentences, which basically say that if you commit a certain crime, if you're charged with a certain crime and convicted of it, that judges have very little to no leeway in sentencing you to anything other than what the law says. And this has resulted in a large number of drug offenders, many of them nonviolent, serving very, very long sentences in state prisons and in the federal prison system.
Back to the federal system in particular, what exactly is Attorney General the Attorney General Holder proposing?
Well, he's proposing a number of things. He has called on U.S. attorneys, who are the federal prosecutors throughout the country, to refrain from charging certain nonviolent drug offenders with mandatory minimum sentences. Most prosecutors have a fair amount of discretion in how they can charge a crime, and by no means are they obligated to charge the offense in a way that will require a mandatory minimum sentence to be imposed upon conviction. And so he, from a practical standpoint, in the federal criminal justice system, the part that he oversees, he is asking U.S. attorneys to refrain from charging in that
They way. Work for him.
They do work for him, although I think it is a point of some open debate about how responsive they are to such voluntary directives. What he's doing, which I think in many ways may be more significant, is he, as the nation's highest law enforcement official, is drawing repeated attention to the fact that the way that the criminal justice system in this country right now functions is, in his own words, which he said to the American Bar Association last August, unfair, unjust, and unsustainable, which is really a remarkable thing for the Attorney General of the United States to say. So in addition to the more mechanistic remedies that he is pointing to, I believe he's very diligently trying to call attention to the signal inefficiencies and also moral failings of the current approach to criminal justice in this country at the federal level.
Back to the issue of drug sentencing for relatively minor crimes. Can you give us some examples? How long are people serving for what kinds of crimes?
Well, so for example, until recently, and one of the issues that has received a lot of attention is that until 2012, there was a 100-to-1 difference in terms of how you were penalized for having crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. Up until the law was changed in 2012, if you possessed small amounts of crack, you were subject to a 5-year mandatory minimum prison sentence. So it's very hard to see what sort of penological or what sort of criminal justice or crime deterrent value is being served by taking somebody with a small amount of crack cocaine and incarcerating them at tremendous taxpayer expense for 5 years. That's one example. There are others.
Well, now that one hasn't been changed, and that one was one that was said to wreak a terrible discriminatory effect because more African Americans used crack and more white people used powder.
That's absolutely right. And so, lest we think that the disparity has been addressed fully, what was a 100-to-1 ratio is now an 18-to-1 ratio. So there's still a disparately harsh penalty for crack cocaine. It's just that it's not as egregiously so as it was before.
Now, the Sentencing Commission. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the Sentencing Commission is where the Attorney General testified today. But there has been legislation reduced, has there not, in order to try to undo the mandatory sentencing?
Yeah, I mean, yes, there is. I mean, there's been a number of bills that have been introduced, and there is a bill that's making its way through the Senate, which has strong bipartisan support. I mean, what's particularly interesting about the Attorney General making his comments at this time and calling for action at this time is we really are finding ourselves, both at the federal and at the state levels, at an interesting moment of bipartisan agreement about this issue. So in the Senate, you have, on the federal level, you have the Attorney General, who's a Democrat, obviously, seemingly able to reach common ground with some of the most conservative senators in the Senate, people like Rand Paul of Kentucky and Mike Lee of Utah, both of whom support changes to mandatory sentencing laws, for reasons perhaps that are different from the Attorney General's motivations. But the fact is that they find themselves having substantial agreements about what the right course of action is.
One of the things they're concerned about is the extraordinary cost of keeping people in prison who have relatively minor league offenses.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's expensive is not only is it the most punitive sanction that, that the state can wield, other than the imposition of a death sentence, that the state can wield against an individual, but it's tremendously expensive. I mean, in this country, we spend nearly $60 billion a year on prison, state and federal. And the recidivism rate, you know, the failure rate, people who are released from prison and who are then find themselves reincarcerated within 3 years, is anywhere between 4 and 10 and 6 and 10, depending on where you're looking. So it, you know, we're spending a lot of money for reasonably bad results.
Okay.
And not a whole lot of proof that the deterrent effect is really that valuable in continuing to suppress the crime rate.
Dan Wilhelm again at the Vera Institute of Justice. Mark Levin is director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He's also senior policy advisor for Right on Crime. That's conservative group advocating for reform of the criminal justice system. Mark Levin, good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Do you agree with the direction in which the Attorney General is going with Rand Paul, apparently, and Mike Lee, very conservative Republican senators, going along?
Well, I do, and I will also say that this really began, I think, several years ago with changes at the state level, in many instances led by conservative governors. Obviously, here in Texas, Governor Rick Perry, and in Georgia, Governor Nathan Deal, a former prosecutor, Governor Kasich and Corbett in Ohio and Pennsylvania, respectively. So in the fifth year of the Obama administration, the Attorney General, of course, made the dramatic announcement last year regarding encouraging prosecutors to use their discretion in terms of not charging low-level drug offenders in a way that leads to the draconian mandatory minimum. So, you know, as we said at the time, we thought the Attorney General, we welcomed him, but we felt he was a bit late to the party. But it's great that everybody's moving in sync right now. And as was alluded to, the Smarter Sentencing Bill, not only co-sponsored by Mike Lee, but also now Ted Cruz, our senator from Texas. And then we have another bill that's a Cornyn bill with Sheldon Whitehouse, another bipartisan bill that was just approved with only 2 votes against in Senate Judiciary that allows lower-level federal inmates to earn time off their sentence by completing programs that reduce recidivism. So it really is encouraging, and it's quite dramatic just from a couple of years ago when no one at the federal level was talking about these types of changes.
Whatever happened to the concern about crime and crack cocaine and cane and random killings such as the Kitty Genovese story, for those who remember it, Mark Levin, where did that fear go?
Well, crime has been declining for 2 decades, so it's not just a perception, but the reality is crime is much lower. Certainly, one doesn't want to trivialize the severe crime problems, particularly in some inner city areas. But what we found is that sending people to prison who have a drug addiction, for example, they'd often only stay for a year or two, and they get out, and it's this churning going in and out of incarceration. And, of course, when they get out, any positive ties they had to employment, to a church, their family, those have been severed. And so they're actually, if they weren't dangerous when they came in, now they're completely destitute. And these low-risk offenders would have encountered many more dangerous people while they were incarcerated. So what we found is for the one thing prisons really do well is incapacitate violent and dangerous offenders, but many of the low-risk and nonviolent inmates coming in, actually, the research has shown they come out worse than they came in, and we could be doing things like drug courts, for example, that have far better outcomes in terms of reducing recidivism, keeping families together, enabling people to earn a living and support their families.
So you and others, then, are in favor of a different kind of treatment, obviously not of letting drug offenders go altogether. What about what we heard earlier from Dan Wilhelm, that there is a moral issue to this? Does that particularly touch a nerve with conservative religious groups?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we have, leaders of some of the largest social conservative and faith-based groups across the country who have signed on to the Right on Crime Statement of Principles, people like Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council. And so it really does touch a chord. And we have many of the folks involved in Right on Crime, like J.C. Watts, the former congressman from Oklahoma. He just visited the Angola prison in Louisiana, and he talks about faith-based and mentoring programs all the time. And the reality is every major religious tradition believes in redemption, the idea that people can change, and programs that really actually provide mentoring that where you can have a mentor meet that offender inside the walls and then help that offender transition and continue to help them on the outside. We have a nonprofit program in Texas called the Prison Entrepreneurship Program, which brings business leaders into prison to talk with inmates. It also has a faith-based but ecumenical component, and they have incredible results in terms of reducing recidivism. They've had ex-offenders go on to start businesses, multi-million dollar businesses.
Again, Mark Levin is director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He's also senior policy advisor for Right on Crime, a conservative group that is concerned about reforming the criminal justice system, as we just heard. We began the program by listening to a very small piece of what Eric Holder had to say to the Sentencing Commission today. Dan Wilhelm, back to you with the Vera Institute of Justice. What happens next? Is the Sentencing Commission able, without legislation, to make the kinds of changes that Attorney General Holder is looking for?
Well, the Sentencing Commission does have some authority to recommend changes. The question that has been a key one for the Sentencing Commission for a long time, however, is how active it is willing to be in what has emerged as a highly contentious and political environment around these crime issues. Now the bipartisanship that I was talking about and that Mark was just referring to, I think very much are a signal that these may be less treacherous waters for the Sentencing Commission to wade into at this point. So, wait and see.
Mark Levin, would you anticipate, particularly given the senators that you named, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and even Sheldon Whitehouse, he's a Democrat, but John Cornyn as well, another Republican, would you assume that the Sentencing Commission could pretty much be allowed to make changes, or would you look for legislation, and do you think that it would get a lot of Republican support? I know Rand Paul has said he thinks it'll get half the Republicans.
Well, both. I mean, my colleague Vikrant Reddy is testifying today before the Sentencing Commission on this change to reduce the drug sentencing by 2 points, the mandatory minimums. And so, but the legislation in Congress is also needed, which would, of course, create a safety valve so judges can go down 50% on these long mandatory minimums for low-level drug offenses. I mean, we have people in federal prison for relatively small amounts of drugs serving 20 or 30 years under these mandatory minimums. So, and of course, there's no parole in the federal system. So, and then, as I said, we've got the earned time bill from Cornyn and White House. So all of the above is needed. The Sentencing Commission has limited powers to make recommendations to Congress and make some adjustments. But undoubtedly, we need to see this move through Congress. And of course, there's still the House of Representatives to come. But this is one of the few issues, really, that has the potential in this election year to make it across the finish line before the end of 2014.
So there really then does appear to be a bipartisan movement, and as you pointed out, this is hardly the environment in which you would anticipate that. We're going to hear more about it as we continue our program. First, we need to take a very brief break. On our talking point later on, we're going to be talking about the CIA and the U.S. Senate. Are they, in fact, spying on each other? We'll hear about Dianne Feinstein and her attack on the CIA, a reluctant one, she said, on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and the way the CIA has responded. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps, available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. It appears we have discovered bipartisanship in the midst of a very partisan environment in Washington. On the issue of mandatory minimum sentences, particularly for drug crimes, the result of the war on drugs and the crime, the fear of crime in the 70s and 80s, which led to a lot of states and the federal government, of course, enacting very harsh sentences, in some cases for relatively minor crimes. We heard at the beginning of our program Eric Holder, the Democratic Attorney General, advocating reform today. Matthew Miller is a former spokesperson for Eric Holder. He's now the Director of Public Affairs for the Director of Public Affairs for the Justice Department. He's now partner at the public affairs firm of Villanovo in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us, Matthew Miller.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Levin said a moment ago he thought that Eric Holder was kind of late to the party. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, there were a number of things he did in the first term. One of the things that was mentioned already in the show was the legislation that passed in 2009 to reduce the crack powder disparity down from 100 to 1. But I think he'd be the first person to tell
you. Down from 100 to 1, but still 18 to 1.
Absolutely. And I remember at the time we wanted to get it to 1 to 1, and there was a big debate whether we should accept that or take nothing and continue to push for 1 to 1, and eventually decided a compromise was better than nothing. But I think Eric Holder would be the first person to tell you that he wanted to do more than what he and the president were able to accomplish in the first 4 years. And in fact, I think that's one of the reasons he came back for the second term, is that there was a lot more he wanted to do in this area. And that's why you've seen him pushing so aggressively, in a number of areas to reform the criminal justice system. And it's partly in sentencing reform. It's also in diversion programs and reentry programs to really make the criminal justice system more fair and more equitable and in the end more effective.
But now he's doing it at a time when he's getting buy-in from Ted Cruz and John Cornyn and Rand Paul and Mike Lee. Why did he wait so long?
Well, like I said, he was pushing for it before, but you know, sometimes the political environment has to match, or the political push has to match the environment, and it has taken time for the environment to get here. There are a number of these policy reforms are reforms that people have pushed, not just for the last 5 or 6 years, but for decades before. But you really had to see I wouldn't say there's a national consensus yet, but we're approaching a consensus, and we're certainly at a point where there's bipartisan agreement that something needs to be done, not just because of the cost to the federal government, but also the cost to communities and the moral implications that have already come up on the show. And so now the environment that we see is one where there is bipartisan support for these things, and you have an attorney general who is the right man for that moment, and that he's pushing aggressively, not waiting for the laws to be changed. It's important that we change the laws, but he's not waiting for them to be changed. He's doing what he can with his executive authority as well.
That's by telling the U.S. attorneys to back off with regard to their discretionary authority to charge people in certain ways.
That's right. That's exactly right. But it's important to note that his directions to U.S. attorneys, as important as they are, a future attorney general can obviously reverse them, and it's one of the reasons why we need to change the law. And one of the reasons why he continues to push for legislation. I think there's a decent chance, as Mark said earlier, that something passes in this year in Congress. But it's certainly not a sure thing at this point. But it's something that we need to do. But I think even in the absence of that, you'll probably continue to see the Attorney General push with a few new initiatives to reform the system.
Matthew Miller, again, former spokesperson for the Attorney General, Eric Holder. Vincent Sutherland is with us, senior counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What's your take on particularly the racial impact, ethnic impact, if you will, of the kinds of laws that we're talking about now, which there seems to be building a bipartisan environment to change?
Well, you know, these laws have had a tremendous impact on communities of color across the country, particularly in the African-American community. And what they've really done is ravaged communities. You're not only taking people out of communities who are able to provide support for families and other things like that, but then when you have folks who reenter society from prison, they're basically are resigned to a civil death in a lot of ways. They're unable to obtain education, unable to obtain economic opportunities and jobs, and oftentimes are completely removed from the political process as well and unable to vote. So these laws have really had a tremendous impact, a tremendous deleterious impact on African Americans and other communities of color.
How much did it help in 2009 when the change was made with regard to crack cocaine as opposed to powder to reduce the ratio of sentencing from 100-1 down to 18-1?
Well, the law, that change did help quite a bit. The problem with that change, however, is that courts have interpreted not retroactively, so that means that the new law, the 18-1 ratio, doesn't apply to or hasn't been applied to those who are still serving those old 100-1 discriminatory sentences. And so you still have some 9,000 or 10,000 individuals still serving these sentences under that old 100-1 regime, the discriminatory regime, and over 90% of them are African Americans. And so you still see that stark racial disproportionality and disparity in that old 100-1 regime.
Is there any mechanism for changing that? Could it be possible to, you know, go to the judges and ask them to change the sentences, or is the law such that once you're in there for that, you're stuck?
Well, there is ongoing litigation right now. There's a case that was just. Petition was sought for certiorari before the United States Supreme Court to try and change that situation, as well as, in that case, Blewett versus the United States, as well as legislation, the Smarter Sentencing Act, which is kind of working its way through Congress, is a piece of legislation that I think clarifies that point about the purpose and scope of the Fair Sentencing Act, which was designed to correct that old discriminatory 100-1 regime, which everyone recognizes should be put in place today in order to kind of correct those injustices of the past.
How do you feel about the Attorney General? Did he, in fact, work as hard in the first term as Matthew Miller indicates that he did, or was that satisfactory? Or do you feel, as Mark Levin said earlier, that he was a little bit late to the party?
You know, I think the Attorney General has done a good job of trying to confront the issues of race and racial bias and disproportionality that have kind of ravaged the criminal justice system for decades. And I think early on, as early as 2009, he kind of confronted head-on the issue of race and caught a lot of flack for it. He said that we were a nation of cowards when it comes to dealing with issues of race. And that was something that I think alarmed some people, but also resonated with a lot of people in this country about the way in which the criminal justice system and the way in which the laws that govern our lives have really shaped outcomes for some people based on the color of their skin. And so I think, you know, over time, and of course all this is a matter of politics and all this is a matter of kind of the institutional players at hand, the Attorney General has done a good job of trying to march through that steady drumbeat of reforming criminal justice laws and reforming some of our federal sentencing laws in a way that's much more kind of empathetic and much more sensible about the way in which we treat people and the way in which we want to not only punish particular crimes, but also acknowledge that one size does not fit all and that there are many more ways to kind of reform and work through some of the issues that tend to ravage communities.
Matthew Miller, back to you. You were spokesperson for Eric Holder. Was there special pressure on him because he is obviously African-American himself? Special pressure in both directions.
Yeah, there absolutely was. And it's something that, you know, the Department of Justice is always controversial. It always deals with controversial issues, many of them racial. And some of those racial issues are polarizing, and they're polarizing no matter who the Attorney General is and what color the Attorney General is. But he, I think, always felt a special obligation, the fact that when you walk into the Department of Justice today, the first two portraits you see are his and the portrait of Barack Obama. And when you think of the department's role throughout history in the desegregation battles of the 1960s on through the civil rights, you know, some of the civil rights work that it's still doing today, a lot of people expect a lot out of the department, being led by someone of Eric Holder's background, his stature, and yes, his race, and I think he feels that, and I think you've seen him implementing policies to reform the criminal justice system, and also, you know, think something we haven't talked about today, to continue to push for civil rights that are in keeping with that, and I think when he does leave office, he'll leave office with a legacy of doing more to expand justice, really, than any attorney general since Bobby Kennedy.
Let me go back to one of the guests from our first half of our program, Mark Levin, who's director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation and also senior policy advisor for Right on Crime. That's a conservative group advocating for reform of the justice system. We heard a moment ago Vincent Sutherland of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund say that people who come out of prison often suffer a kind of civil death with inability to get education, to get jobs, or to participate in politics. You yourself, I think, mentioned reentry and the problems that people have, particularly when they have been incarcerated for long periods of time. What about getting back into the political system and this whole idea of giving felons or former felons, I should say, rehabilitated felons, the right to vote? Is that on your agenda?
Well, it's not something we've focused a great deal on. We've generally been more focused on issues of employment and housing. For example, we here in Texas have passed legislation that we helped write that would allow ex-offenders to get certain occupational licenses on a provisional basis after they're, if they're on probation or after they're discharged from prison. We had found we were actually training people in prison to be barbers, and then they couldn't get a license to be a barber once they got out of prison. And the other thing we did just in the 2013 session was pass legislation providing liability relief to employers who hire ex-offenders so they can't be sued in most instances for negligent hiring, which we had found was a real deterrent to hiring ex-offenders. But certainly the voting issues are being litigated, and I think that there is certainly a trend towards allowing individuals who aren't in prison to at some point participate in elections. I think that it's state by state in terms of, I think the state with the most disenfranchised ex-offenders is Florida, so it's been a particularly salient issue there.
Let me go back to Dan Wilhelm at the Vera Institute of Justice. Is that important, do you think, the political issue along with education and along with jobs?
Well, I think it is, because I'm not sure what the compelling rationale is for not wanting someone who has paid his or her debt to society to be a fully contributing and functioning member of that society. I mean, you know, we are counting on people after they leave prison to rebuild their lives and to get jobs and to get education and to be responsible to their families and to contribute to their communities. And what more salient example of taking one's responsibilities seriously can there be than in exercising the right to franchise? And so, that combined with the notion that, you know, what I said just a moment ago, the idea of paying one's debt to society very much became an idea that sort of fell out of vogue as we, as a nation, continued to ratchet up the penalties and to continue to place punishment and retribution above notions such as those related to rehabilitation and to fulfilling of one's obligations. And so the fact that you would impose legally a prohibition against someone being able to vote, as well as limiting their access to education and employment, really does go hand in glove with that idea of this place that where we found ourselves as a nation, where we didn't want the punishment to end. We wanted to keep them in prison as long as we could, and even when they got out, we wanted to punish them more and more. And that may feel good to some people in some instances, but as we've been discussing, you know, the research doesn't support the beneficial effects of doing that. And these people all come home, almost all of them do. Well over 95% do, and you know, when they come home, don't you want them to be contributing good members of society? And if so, then you know, we know how to do that. We know the sorts of training and supports that you can give people while they're in prison, while still holding them accountable for their actions, so that their chances of succeeding and contributing to their communities are greatly enhanced when they're home.
Vincent Sutherland, back to you at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. You're the one who brought this up, and I'm wondering, obviously, voting changes and voting rules change from a state to state. How difficult do you think this one is going to be to overcome, given the history of voting rights in the United States?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it is a challenge, of course. You know, Attorney General Eric Holder did call for states to try and revise some of these felon disfranchisement laws across the country. And, of course, that is a state-by-state issue. And it's something, but it's certainly something that's worth fighting for. It's certainly something that's indicative of our need to really think through what happens when people actually come back to society and reenter society after serving these sentences and becoming more productive members of society, and really removing the barriers for them from them to kind of reintegrate. And it's important to think about these felon disfranchisement laws as almost kind of a vestige of racist policies of the South after the Civil War. And it all kind of grows out of this historical context of trying to use the criminal justice system as a way to keep individuals from fully participating in society. And that's not the legacy that I think any of us want to perpetuate, particularly when there's no rational reason, really, to prevent someone from once they've served their sentence and paid their debt to society, to participating in fully in that society.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us. And, of course, we'll look for the progress on the reform in sentencing laws and some of the issues that we talked about as well, reentry of people from prisons and what their civil rights are once they are out. Great to have you all. Vincent Sutherland with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, Matthew Miller, formerly with the Attorney General Eric Holder, now with Villanovo in Washington, Mark Levin at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and Right on Crime, Dan Wilhelm of the Vera Institute of Justice. Good to have you all on our program, and thanks very much for joining us. Early this week, California Democrat Dianne Feinstein said she reluctantly took to the Senate floor to denounce the CIA for violating the constitutional separation of powers. The CIA Director John Brennan denied that. It's all about the brutal interrogation of terrorist suspects during the Bush administration. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Well, we're not only back with today's talking point. Senator Feinstein accused the CIA of trying to sabotage the work of the Intelligence Committee, which she chairs. That work includes legislative oversight of the CIA, which is part of the executive branch. That's where the separation of powers issues comes in. Turns out that the committee staff, her committee staff, had also uncovered a CIA report that the agency tried to keep secret. Greg Miller is going to sort it all out for us. He is with the Washington Post intelligence reporter. And Greg Miller, it's always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Tell us, if you will, were they both spying on each other?
Well, I mean, the term spying here may be stretched a bit. What the agency's been accused of here is looking through computers that the agency owned and set up to enable the Senate Intelligence Committee to review millions of documents related to that interrogation program. What the agency claims is all it did was look through the logs of those of the accessing of those documents to try to figure out where and how the committee came into possession of a certain set of documents the agency never intended to share. So to the committee, they regarded that as highly troubling, and they have characterized that as spying. The agency sees it very differently.
Now, what was the nature of this set of documents that the CIA had not intended to pass on to the Intelligence Committee?
Well, this is such an odd thing, Warren, because it's hard to when you hear about them, it's hard to understand why these have become so significant. This was essentially an effort set up by the agency after it had agreed to cooperate with the committee in turning over records to keep track of what it was turning over. It was basically trying to assemble an inventory. These are the files that are going out the door today. These are the files going out the door tomorrow. This is what they say. And as they made this inventory, apparently, some CIA staff or employees were also making notes on the contents of those documents and how damaging it might be, they might become once they were in the committee's hands. So, these are not original documents that coincide with the operation of the secret prisons or the interrogation. They don't even exist until this committee investigation is underway. But once the committee finds out about these and realizes that some of those notes seem to have observations about the underlying documents that match the committee's own, they want them, right? I mean, they back up the committee's interpretation of these files.
Now, the interpretation then becomes important, and I take it that it has to do with just how serious the abuses were that took place during the interrogations.
Right. Not only the abuses, but but other episodes. I think that what we will find when and if we ever see this, you know, 6,000-page report on the interrogation program is other examples of abuses that haven't come to light yet that may have been isolated incidents, weren't really incorporated into the program, but nevertheless occurred. As well as, you know, the committee has made clear that they think they have found abundant evidence of mismanagement of this program and of dishonesty by CIA officials in describing how the program was being run to lawmakers and even to the White House, and how effective this interrogation program was.
So what we have here then is this what starts out sounding like sort of a trivial issue with people trying to keep track of the log, which investigation, incidentally, that arrangement of keeping track was set up by a former CIA director, Panetta. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It was under his instruction, and it was essentially a way to make sure that CIA leaders weren't blindsided with what the committee learned from these files, right? If you're the CIA director, you've agreed to turn over all this stuff to the committee, you want to know what you're giving away before it comes back and hits you publicly.
And then what the CIA people did was add to that in a way by taking these notes on whether or not the information they were passing would in fact be damaging or seem damaging. And somehow the committee staff got a hold of those notes.
Right. And how they did that is one of the fundamental questions here, because the agency insists that, you know, these documents were never pushed into this shared network that the committee had had access to. They resided on a separate drive that was connected to that network but was hidden behind a firewall. This was supposed to be the agency's own space on this network, not for the committee to access. And in her remarkable floor speech this week, Senator Feinstein asserted that the committee found this set of documents just simply by searching, just using the search tool that the agency had provided on this database. But she was careful, I thought, not to be explicit about how it then obtained those records and extracted them, which leaves open this question. And this is why the agency has gone so far, it's really extraordinary, has referred this to the Justice Department. They are alleging there was a crime here in how the committee came by these documents.
Well, one of the things the senator said was that maybe some whistleblower was responsible for this in some way.
Right. She listed a couple of possible scenarios without saying exactly which one was the case.
So now the Justice Department is investigating the CIA's effort to report to the Oversight Committee, which was investigating the CIA. I mean, it gets pretty hard just to complete a sentence about this.
Sure. You're right. We're just tied up in knots at this point. And the Justice Department has, as far as we know, has not agreed to investigate any of this stuff. Maybe they will, but that hasn't happened yet. But you could understand why they'd be reluctant to get in the middle of this fight.
Well, of course, they are a part of the executive branch, as is the CIA. Might the Senate, might Senator Feinstein ask the Justice Department to investigate?
Well, I mean, she could ask, but the agency actually has the authority to submit a referral. You know, they routinely refer reports to the Justice Department when they think there is an incident of a crime, a potential crime has occurred regarding classified material or whatever. And they haven't specified what that suspected crime was in this case, but we do know that a referral was made.
Well, what is the overall significance of this in terms of government secrecy, something we've been hearing a lot about, particularly since the revelations about the National Security Agency?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, The real significance of these documents, as I said, to the agency and to the committee is nothing to do with the underlying report, which is already finished and doesn't even reference these documents. It's for what comes next, which is inevitably going to be a fight about how this report is seen and interpreted and regarded. So if the committee has in its possession, you know, CIA files that seem to corroborate the committee's version of history here, it will have a really, powerful shield to ward off any effort by the CIA to discredit or criticize that report. I mean, in terms of the broader Senator Feinstein has said, you know, this is a defining moment in the oversight of intelligence agencies. And the public clash is certainly remarkable here. But there have been, you know, by that standard, there have been a number of defining moments throughout the history of these sort of the tense relationship between these two bodies.
But in this case, this 6,000-page report that you just referred to that hasn't been released as yet apparently is even more damaging to the CIA and its behavior than what we have already heard. It would appear that's one of the reasons the CIA is so worried about it.
Yeah, and John Brennan, who is now the CIA director, wasn't at the agency when this report, when this research and this report was done, but he now runs it, and he feels obligated to sort of stand up for that workforce. They assert that they want this to be fair, there have been other reports on the interrogation program. We've seen the declassification and release of the CIA's Inspector General's report on that program, which was eye-opening. It talked about things like the use of drills and guns in interrogation sessions to scare prisoners. It documented the sheer number of times that prisoners were waterboarded. But this is 6,000 pages that go beyond even that IG report, which was several hundred.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is the most comprehensive look at the records pertaining to this interrogation program that has ever happened.
As I said, you would help us sort it all out. You certainly have. Greg Miller, again, intelligence reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.